The following program from the North Carolina Reading Service is intended for our listeners who are blind and or print impaired. And of course it's the Indie Week, the Independent, and I'm John Federson here to read our weekly issue dated April the 26th of 2024. I'm going to get to it because it's a very thick folder of stories this week. Here we go. And we begin over in Durham. Lauren Pelavanian reports, after months of uncertainty about the school system's payroll and budget, the public had a chance to speak on Interim Superintendent Kathy Moore's proposed budget for Durham Public Schools at a public hearing Thursday. And for a change, the mood in the boardroom was pretty calm. Many speakers expressed gratitude for the superintendent's proposal, while advocating for more funding for Exceptional Children, EC, and English as a Second Language, ESL, staff. The proposed budget includes a long-awaited decision on the classified workers' salaries for the upcoming year. If approved, the budget would allocate nearly $9 million in increased compensation for these workers. It comes after a stormy few months for the school system. In October, classified workers were given pay raises only to have them rescinded when the DPS leaders learned the raises exceeded the school system's budget by millions of dollars. The series of events angered workers, leaving protests and school cancellations in their wake. Kathy Moore called the proposed budget increase, which totals just over $26 million, a bold ask. But she said it doesn't represent everything that is needed. Still, teachers, classified staff, and families pushed for more funding towards EC and ESL teachers and staff in particular. Earl Williams, an EC teacher at Hillside High, urged the board to consider creating a separate salary schedule for EC teachers, including $200 per month raise for EC and ECL teachers. Vacancies abound in these classrooms across Durham Public Schools, Williams said, in part because current compensation levels do not reflect the difficulty of the job, saying one guy left because he could make more money working as a bag attendant at RDU Airport. The Sky Deal, an ESL teacher, shared similar experiences as chair of that department at Northern High. I became department chair kind of by default because everyone else left, they said. Still, they expressed gratitude toward the board for reinstating pay raises for these classified workers. That's going to be a difference for whether they stay this year or not, so I really appreciate that. The proposed budget would implement pay raises for these classified workers similar to those laid out in the original study, said Moore. While not identical, she said their cost and objectives would be similar. Quote, there are some differences in it, but it would be implementing market rate schedules for classified and completing the work that started in the past year. The proposed budget also would raise DPS teachers' annual starting salary supplement from $6,450 to $7,250. That would make Durham's starting teaching supplement the highest in North Carolina as of now, said Moore. The proposal also requests over $1 million to pay bonuses to teachers with relevant master's degree, which would affect 200 teachers in the DPS. Over $2 million is requested for pre-kindergarten classrooms in the new Murray Massenburg Elementary and general building repairs. Nearly $4 million would fund the charter schools. The school board is expected to vote on the proposed budget on April 25th. Why, what do you know? That was just yesterday, or today, actually, Thursday. The county commission will then decide whether to approve the school system's local funding request. Many speakers also said they would stand by the board as it looks to have its funding proposal approved by the commission. Heaton said, if you need our help, let us know. We will help you. Interestingly now, folks, my Durham folder contains very little that's very extraordinarily depressing or worrisome or conflict-ridden. Our first article says women lead in making Durham a sports destination at all levels of play. When Kara Hess asked for a show of hands from returning attendees at the Emerging Women in Sports Leadership Summit, EWSLS, in late March, only a few signaled their return. The Durham Convention Center was packed to the brim with young women sporting business casual attire and Nike Dunks, but most were newcomers to the newish summit. It was co-hosted by the Durham Sports Commission, DSC, and Women's Leaders in Sports. The EWSLS gave attendees the opportunity to network within a quickly growing industry. Hess, the Deputy Director of Leadership, Development, and Events at Women Leaders in Sports, kicked off the six-hour summit with a warm welcome and an icebreaker before settling into the rest of the afternoon's presentations and power talks. This year's summit is its second iteration from the DSC, which is a relatively new nonprofit dedicated to growing collegiate, amateur, and professional sports in and around Durham. The group's work in sports tourism has attracted numerous high-profile events, such as the National Collegiate Fencing Championships and the NAIA Football National Championship. It's also a supporter of local recreational leagues, including the Durham League, a popular adult recreational basketball league. Although few returning attendees made it to this year's summit, the presence of newcomers is a testament of DSC's commitment to growing the local sports scene. Kayla Shea Menendez, Deputy Director of DSC, recognizes the key role women are playing in making sports accessible for everyone. The Durham League, for instance, was founded by a woman, Robin Jackson, in 2016, and it has since expanded from a women's only league to include a men's league, 35 plus years old league, and a 50 plus years old league. Menendez says, "We want to be cutting edge. That's the fabric of Durham. We know that there is a need for women in leadership positions in sports, and there's a lot of momentum right now around women in sports." This year's March Madness tournament was a boon for women's basketball. The surge in popularity led by former University of Iowa sharpshooter Caitlin Clark brought in a wave of new fans to the sport. Triangle-based teams were also well represented in the women's bracket, with Duke, UNC Chapel Hill, and NC State all participating in the tournament. The Wolfpack women's team climbed all the way to the Final Four alongside the men. "We talk a lot about being a championship hub," said Menendez. "With the universities, the professional teams that are saturated here in this area, powerhouse college teams that are here at every level, Division I, II, and III, there are women who work in sports and so be able to provide this opportunity right here in such a great area within the Triangle region is something that's unique to Durham." Lindsay Harding, the former Duke women's basketball star and the number one overall pick in the 2007 WNBA draft, is currently a front runner for the Charlotte Hornets head coaching job. She would be the first woman in the history of the NBA to hold that position. Further down Tobacco Road, 23-year-old Aaron Mattson, UNC women's field hockey player turned coach, became the youngest collegiate head coach to win an NCAA title. Mattson took over as head coach in 2023, a year after rattling off four national championships as a player with the program. Stories like Harding's and Mattson's are a source of motivation for women in sports on and off the field. Take it from Nina King, the vice president and athletic director at Duke University. A longtime player in the industry, King is just one of the women pioneering the move toward growing Durham's collegiate sports scene, saying, "Sports has the power to inspire. It unites us in so many different ways. We can rally behind a common goal, wanting our team to win, whatever that team is, just watching the growth, exposure, investment, and interest around women's sports in particular has been really exciting to watch. Duke Athletics works hand-in-hand with DSC on a number of events. Both share a common goal to expand the professional sports industry in Durham, so their mutual interest manifests itself in bids for championship-level collegiate events and establishing Duke as the perfect blend of academics and athletics. The DSC Summit is a key component of the movement at large, with speaker sessions titled things like Vision Fueled by Motivation and Best Strategies to Elevate Your Communication. Attendees heard advice from leaders who know firsthand how difficult breaking into the industry can be. Icebreakers, quick breaks for conversation, and roundtables kept the summit lively, contributing to an all-round environment of inclusion and an undeniable love of sports. And Menendez said, "This particular age group or range of industry leaders are at a place where either they're stepping into the industry and then navigating to other opportunities within sports. We're really excited about navigating transitions conversation. We're also excited about the opportunity to provide attendees with a networking opportunity." Well, this is an athletic-related, certainly, article. It's a longish article, and it kind of moves from the dynamic, forward-thinking Durham article, of which I have another one I'll read after this. This one by Jessica Walker, examining the impact of legalized sports betting on college athletes, gamblers, and North Carolina. The student athletes on UNC Chapel Hill's basketball team have received negative messages from fans expecting certain performances before. But now that sports betting is legal in North Carolina as of March 11th, those messages and pressure from sports bettors may increase. Carter Hicks, baseball director of player and program development, said that legalized sports betting and access to social media provide an avenue for fans to share their opinions. Sometimes that's at the expense of the players. Hicks said they live in this circle that people are betting on, and if things don't happen the way bettors want, if we don't win a game, if we don't have an outcome that someone bet on, our players are going to hear about that, and sometimes it's not always in the nicest way. UNC Chapel Hill cross-country and track athlete Michael Spragley said, "Although betting can make sports more interesting, something should be done about fan comments toward athletes." He said the regulation of these should fall on the betting agencies. Spragley said the betting companies should put out educational campaigns emphasizing the humanity behind athletes to help the average fan realize that they're betting on real people. Spragley said they see them as dollars, as opportunity to make money. But these are human beings. They got hopes and dreams and anxieties and stress. On top of being an athlete, Spragley, originally from Chesterfield, Virginia, is now a graduate student at UNC Chapel Hill. He said sports betting adds pressure onto student athletes that may even affect their quality of play. Quote, "As an athlete, I have pressure myself to perform. Pressure from coaches, family, friends, that's enough in itself. But if you add betting on top of that, you can win a game and then somebody boos you because you hadn't scored enough points. I feel that's a lot to have on an 18, 19, 20-year-old. Justin, a better and UNC Chapel Hill senior who asked to remain partially anonymous, admitted that betting on sports has changed his view of certain athletes. He said it's a professional athlete's job to perform well and be an asset for their team, so he understands why they may get slack from frustrated bettors. But he doesn't agree with sending negative messages to student athletes. He said, "I am also friends with people on some sports teams here, and I've seen and heard some of the hate messages they've got for not performing to where they were supposed to. I don't think you should ever want someone to die, but I think you could be upset if someone that's normally the rebound guy suddenly forgets how to rebound and has like one rebound by the end of the game. That's very frustrating. Spragley said the integrity of track races could become problematic if betting on track was a bigger deal. It would be easy to run slower and throw a race if athletes felt the pressure of bets, said Spragley. And that's part of the reason why athletes can't bet on sports, according to NCAA rules. President Charlie Baker recently posted a statement urging lawmakers to ban collegiate-level prop betting, where bets are based on individual accomplishments of individual players. In the statement, he mentioned his concern over prop betting's effect on the integrity of games and athlete harassment. However, Mark Nichols, a professor of economics at the University of Nevada, Reno, said prop betting also increases fan engagement. When sports betting initially became legal in Nevada, bettors couldn't wage on college teams because of fear of athlete corruption or players throwing a game if they had money riding on it. After leagues realized they could enhance viewership, prop betting was permitted, they said. What a surprise. While sports betting is expected to lean to more fan engagement, that increased involvement may not always be positive because money is on the line. Spragley said, athletes are not there just to entertain. They're there to reach their goals. Just remember, if you're placing a bet or even chewing at a player online, just remember that there is a human. James Whalen, professor of psychology at University of Memphis and the executive director of the Tennessee Institute for Gambling Education and Research, acronym TIGER, said sports betting reaches a younger audience because of the nature of sports culture in the U.S. Quote, right now, the attention is particularly on young men. Why? Well, many young men, not all, but many, grow up paying attention to sports. It's a dialogue that they have every day with their friends. Since they pay attention to SportsCenter and check the box scores, often they feel confident, he said. And when you feel confident about something, you're more likely to engage on it. And so sports betting specifically appeals to those people who are fairly invested in knowing things about the sports they're interested in. Additionally, promotional advertising of a multitude of betting platforms and opportunities in North Carolina has become more intense now that sports wagering is legal, possibly contributing to its new audience of gamblers. Justin said, it's all over TV. I see it all over my socials. They're pressing really, really hard to make people in North Carolina gamble, and I mean, it's definitely working. I've definitely heard more conversations about gambling within the last month than I've probably ever heard. The opportunity to make money is also drawing people to gambling. Betting in the form of sports is more approachable and understandable than stock trading, for example, and for those who have a passion for certain athletes, teams, or sports, said Justin. Quote, I think the reason a lot of people in our generation are doing it is because things are more expensive than ever. And I think people feel like there's a lot in the world they don't understand or they don't know how to control. And although the sports book always has the higher hand or the better odds, I think more people see it these days that they can beat the system. And I think you can. One thing Justin said he learned was never to bet money he doesn't feel comfortable losing. He said it's important to spend as little of your actual money as possible, which is what happened after UNC Chapel Hill's men's basketball Sweet 16 loss during March Madness. Justin lost about $100, but the loss was in bonus bets or an in-app credit that's only valid in the sportsbook and can be used to make real money. That tactic is something he's learned after a couple of years of betting, but it's a safety practice that is not a guarantee for everyone. The issue of overbetting and increased debt was a common concern over betting's legalization in the state in the first place. North Carolina's sports wagering bill initially failed in 2022 in the Senate. In 2023, it was approved in a 38-11 vote. The bill survived 17 failed amendments in the House before finally passing in June 2023. Even the most recent vote was divided, 69 in favor, 44 against. Representative Frank Sossaman, Republican of Greenville, voted against over concerns for the families of North Carolina. He said that, as a pastor, he's seen the other side of betting and gambling, including debt, addiction, domestic abuse, or high suicide rates. I've seen all those negative effects, he said, and I think it's wrong for leadership to make a little money at the social expense of our families, and that's the reason I'm against gambling and against sports betting, and that's the reason I did everything under the sun to try to get it not to pass. He said he tried to encourage safeguards to gambling, like requiring credit cards or placing a limit on bets. However, without the safeguards he sought, he said he could not support the bill. Quote, "No amount of money is worth what gambling has the potential to do to a person and how it has a way to transform their thinking. Even the person they used to be, they no longer are." Representative Zach Hawkins, a Democrat of Durham, said he sponsored the bill for multiple reasons, including financial benefit, but agreed that consumer protection and responsible participation are the primary goals, while revenue is secondary. He said about $2 million from betting revenue will go towards support for issues with gambling addiction. The North Carolina Problem Gambling Program will provide supports like education, outreach, and treatment services throughout North Carolina. It currently receives $1 million from money raised by the state lottery, but by the next fiscal year, it will receive $3 million a year, according to the NC State Lottery Commission. The commission also established a voluntary self-exclusion program that was required by state law to minimize the risk of harm that could come from sports betting or any other type of gaming. Hawkins said there are also limits and safeguards on some of the betting apps. Quote, "I wanted to make sure that even down to the platform, people were able to participate, but do so responsibly. And that's just like any other thing we participate in. It's okay to do it, but we don't want people to do it in excess that would cause them harm." The Lottery Commission will help with oversight, and Hawkins said, if the betting companies aren't responsible actors, there's no guarantee they will remain in the state. He added, if they can't be good actors for the people in North Carolina, they don't deserve to do business. Hawkins said betting could bring over $100 million to North Carolina based on early indications of interest. He said the revenue will be spent in positive ways. Quote, "The revenue that's coming in has some real-life applications and opportunities, but then, of course, most importantly, we hope it will continue to spur economic development. About 50% of the revenue from betting will go into the state's general fund, which is the primary fund for state government expenditures. The other 50% will go towards supporting youth sports programs for facility upgrades and sports equipment for those who can't afford it." Quote Hawkins, "As a state that is growing, and especially a state that's importing a lot of people from around the country, we sort of need to start moving in the direction of some of our peer states. But most importantly, we have to stop missing out on revenue that's going to other states." Pardon me. Neighboring states, Virginia, Tennessee, and Kentucky, have legalized sports betting in person and online, while South Carolina and Georgia have not. Nichols, the Utah professor, who has researched betting and gambling nationally, said that now it's legal in North Carolina, people may bet more in-state rather than overseas. If it's already taking place, North Carolina, I think, is being smart. Well, why are we missing out on that? We might as well legalize it, bring it in-house, and us get that money, as opposed to wherever it was going. In the first week of legalized sports betting, North Carolinians wagered almost $200 million, according to the Lottery Commission. The state received $42.7 million in gross wagering revenue, which is the total wagers minus winnings. While betting may make money for fans and the state, from an athlete's perspective, betting takes away something valuable from sports, said Spragley. It can affect an athlete's performance, quality of play, and overall experience competing. And he says, now fan engagement in sports may just be about entertainment and money. It might also contribute to the loss of heart of the sport, which is just having fun competing. All right, halfway through our cast for today comes Durham Entrepreneurs Are Working to Make the City Less Wasteful. The headquarters for the Re-Collective, a waste management company based in Durham, is crammed inside a small loading dock. Piles of variable plastic, cardboard, and glass line the walls. Orange pill bottles and chunks of styrofoam are sorted into large bags while other materials wait to be categorized. Textiles are churning in the washing machine. Bryce Brooks, who co-founded Re-Collective in 2022 alongside Kevin Young, has been laboring over the mound of junk for hours, but maintains her enthusiasm for the job. She takes a beat to admire the day's work, saying, it still smells like honey in here sometimes. The lingering odor is thanks to the previous tenants, the brothers Vilgelis, creators of the Kupernikus honey liqueur. The Re-Collective offers door-to-door service to residents who want to more thoroughly sort and discard the waste they generate at home. Brooks previously worked as a consultant helping businesses understand how to reduce waste through their own operations. She saw an opportunity to help bring those best practices to residential neighborhoods, and the Re-Collective now has more than 400 members across the triangle. Brooks says, when we think about end solutions in terms of the reuse of perfectly good pill bottles or boxes and stuff like that, it becomes the upstream solution for the beginning of someone else's journey. Because if they're not buying a virgin plastic to use for this box or this thing, then we've prevented the waste from happening in the first place for them. Every time you throw something away, it's hauled away to the local solid waste facility to be processed and sorted. But tons of items lying around the house, materials used for shipping packages, plastic bags used to carry groceries, and old batteries are not biodegradable, which means they're destined to sit in landfills for hundreds or thousands of years. The environmental impact of landfill waste is most acutely felt by residents of Sampson County, 1.5 hours southeast of Durham, where the bulk of Durham's trash is shipped and stored. 25 million tons of garbage are rotting in the Sampson County landfill, according to a 2023 report from North Carolina Newsline. Due to this decomposition, the facility emits the second most methane gas of any landfill in the country, causing environmental harm and poor health outcomes for that community. With the threats spurred on by climate change feeling more present by the day, Brooks, Young, and a handful of other entrepreneurs in Durham including the founders of Don't Waste Durham, have taken up the challenge of supplementing the city's waste reduction efforts by making reduce and reuse a seamless part of everyday life for residents. Even the most earnest tree huggers can find it difficult to properly dispose of all the different waste they create on a daily basis. Without clear directions from manufacturers or the city, most residents default to tossing items in the trash can or the recycling bin, unaware of how it will be processed downstream. Brooks says she sticks to a few fundamentals when in doubt. Quote, I'm pretty confident when I stick to bottles, cans, tubs, jugs, and jars. That's the mantra I have in my head. The City of Durham provides a recycling guidelines search tool on its website to inform residents on the best method for disposing of items they may be unsure about. Many of those items, the ones that are often not suitable for the regular trash and recycling pickup, are the types of products that the Recollective hauls away. Folks who sign up for Recollective get a collection of bags that separate waste into four categories: plastic films, textiles, styrofoam, and batteries and bulbs. Those materials are picked up monthly from each customer and brought back to the facility, where they're sorted and redistributed to other recycling depots or nonprofits that repurpose the products. Items that fall outside the regular collection categories are sometimes included in the company's monthly Reco Picks. That's a one-time pickup for a different specialty item that could be as small as wine corks or as big as a car seat. Brooks says while she enjoys helping to combat waste and bring this necessary service to residents, her hope is that private industry and the public sector can work to prevent waste at the source. Quote, if we designed waste out of the problem, if we lived in a world where these things were returned to their manufacturer or all of our local things were made in reusable containers and just simply washed and reused, recycling would not have to be the savior or Hail Mary that people think of it as. Waste is managed in three ways: mitigation, diversion, and prevention. Mitigation includes actions like picking up litter or having your trash hauled away to a landfill. Efforts to mitigate the waste that gets into the environment. Recycling and composting are examples of diversion services and help keep some materials in circulation by breaking them down and repurposing them. Many of the services Recollective offers are about diversion. But for Crystal Dreisbach, founder of Don't Waste Durham, the ultimate goal is prevention. Building a network of products and services that keep wasteful materials from being created in the first place. In 2017, Don't Waste Durham started the Green to Go program. It partnered with other local businesses to provide reusable containers for customers to use when ordering takeout. After a customer finishes their meal, they can return the container to any business participating in the Green to Go program. The containers are then washed at a licensed facility and returned to the businesses. To launch the program, Don't Waste Durham needed special permitting to create the washing facility. Dreisbach found allies at Durham County Health Department who worked with Dreisbach to come up with a proposal. Through that partnership, the Health Department and Don't Waste Durham took their collaboration to the next level, advocating for the recognition of reusables as an industry and convincing the NC Board of Health to change the food code to allow reusables, unlocking new potential for the development of a circular economy in Durham. Dreisbach says, a huge lesson I learned is that policy and innovation must go together a policy cannot be changed unless people have their minds open to a different way. And then that innovation cannot be scaled until the policy passes. So they really need each other. At a city council work session last September, the Duke Environmental Law and Policy Clinic and Don't Waste Durham presented a proposal to limit the use of plastic bags at local retailers through a small 10-cent fee at checkout. Nancy Lauer, a staff scientist at the Duke Clinic, said the manufacturing of plastics, such as the bags found at groceries or containers at fast food restaurants, take a heavy toll on the health of marginalized communities, and their convenience is not cheap. Lauer said, "The plastics we are suggesting solutions for, these are ones that cannot be recycled. If we were to zoom out and took this full life cycle, it's really hard to justify their convenience based on the cost that these plastics bear to the low-income and communities of color at the beginning of their life during production and the extraction of oil and gas, during the plastics manufacturing, and at the end of their life when we dispose of them in Sampson County landfill." Community members raised concerns during the research process about the equitability of the bag tax. Brooks says a 10-cent fee should not be easily dismissed for residents who are already just struggling to make ends meet. Brooks says people are like, "What's the big deal? It's only 10 cents for a bag." Well, you've never been so poor that if you're overdrafted by 10 cents for that single bag, you get charged $35. In response, Don't Waste Durham created the Boomerang Bag Program in partnership with So Crafty, S-E-W, So Crafty, to help alleviate some of those equity concerns. They created a system of reusable bags with recycled textiles from groups like the ReCollective that customers could access for free at checkout to entice them away from choosing plastic. Michelle Nowlin, co-director of the Duke Environmental Law and Policy Clinic, also recommended the city exempt SNAP, WIC, and Medicaid recipients from paying that bag fee as part of the proposal to the city council. Unfortunately for advocates, the North Carolina General Assembly preempted the initiative in its own budget proposal just days before the city clinic's presentation, restricting municipalities across North Carolina from implementing rules like the plastic bag tax. Don't Waste Durham still piloted the reusable program with two stores in Durham, Save-A-Lot, which has since closed, and King's Red and White. But the interference from the NCGA restricted how progressive the city could be with waste management solutions. "Not only are we disappointed and frustrated with this action," says Nowlin, "but we're also very frustrated and disappointed for the city because you still bear the responsibility for managing waste. That is a statutory mandate and part of your duties to protect public health and welfare of the community members. The General Assembly is now poised to make you do that with both hands tied behind your back and prevent you from taking actions to reduce waste and protect the interests of the community." Even with this setback, the city of Durham is making strides to bring reuse to its own operations. Last year, staff began a feasibility study through a partnership with a nonprofit FUSE Executive Fellowship Program to bring a state-of-the-art recycling facility called the Reuse Hub Project. The facility would allow the department to tackle the use of disposables across Durham. Katie Hunt is program coordinator for the FUSE Fellowship. She holds a doctorate in environmental communication and political economy for the University of Utah and has worked for decades as an advocate for Environmental Justice and Equitable Sustainability. Last fall, Hunt published an analysis based on feedback from the community and data from the city about how to approach building a circular economy with equity as the core value. She says that, unlike other communities who have introduced the concept of a circular economy, equity has been a top priority for Durham. Quote, "Very few of them center equity in terms of the orchestration of these activities and the participation of frontline communities in developing the projects and then benefiting from the outcome of those activities. And it is truly a mark of distinction for the city of Durham that they have centered that commitment in the strategic planning around the Circular Economy Initiative from the beginning. The Reuse Hub would provide the city of Durham with a suite of tools to increase its capacity for managing waste products. Operation of the facilities and development of new sustainable products that would be used throughout the community are potential jobs for Durham residents," says Hunt. "Job training and certification programs would be available through partnerships with local organizations like Durham Technical Community College and Step Up Durham, as well as the city's Office of Economic and Workforce Development." And Hunt says, "This is going to require systems change, and that system change requires multiple entities working in tandem in that coordinated way. Activists are often despondent about the effect of individual shifts in behavior when it comes to climate change. The root cause of the issue is with major corporations like plastic manufacturers, whose business practices contribute the bulk of emissions in the United States. But folks like Brooks and Dreisbach are confident that changes at the local level will have an upstream impact on the ways corporations conduct their business, and that it's important to teach residents about the agency they have in effecting change in their own communities. Dreisbach notes that Durham Public Schools use more than 50,000 disposable items like lunch trays and plastic utensils every day. She says the amount of waste the school system creates sends the wrong message to students who are actively learning about sustainability during class. Dreisbach says that's insane, and it's ridiculous for teachers and Durham Public Schools who are telling Don't Waste Durham it's not just the endocrine disruptors that are messing up our children, it's the moral harm we're doing to them. Because they're in class learning to care for the earth, and then they go to lunch. It's like messing up the development of their sense of what integrity is, and trust in systems and adults. They're forever screwed. Is that what we want for our kids? Okay, Hannah Kaufman has authored this a story about a new community mental health program supporting Latino residents in Orange County. For 24 years, Diana Huerta has been the only member of her family living in the United States. The rest, still in Mexico, are in touch often, but talking to them on the phone doesn't cure anxiety and depression she feels from being isolated in a primarily English-speaking area. Huerta tried to get on the wait list for the only bilingual therapy clinic in Orange County, El Futuro, but there was always too much demand. Then the Carborough location shut its doors in 2015, and she lost hope, turning to virtual sessions with a therapist in Colombia, just so she could speak with someone who understands her. Huerta says in Spanish, "We realize there is a lot of need, especially in the Hispanic community, about mental health in the absence of clinics and therapists, especially with the language." Then last May, Huerta and others, hundreds of other Latino community members in Orange County joined together to demand mental health support from Alliance Health. That's a private managed care organization, an MCO, that serves uninsured residents and those who receive Medicaid in Orange County. Their call was answered with a $500,000 donation, which has gone into El Futuro's services and community program for Orange County. That's what sparked the program Mentes Fuertes, or Strong Minds. Part of a new community health initiative from El Futuro, the program includes 10 free psychoeducation sessions for Orange County residents who are at least 18 years old and have symptoms of anxiety or depression. El Futuro hired 4 community health workers, CHW, to deliver the sessions. All of them speak Spanish and spent months undertaking the intensive training that's part of Mentes Fuertes curriculum that's adapted from cognitive behavioral therapy and modeled after a similar program at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. According to Estefania Castro, the project's manager, and Castro says, it's a program that we know works. It's evidence-based, and it takes a lot of skills from different therapies, from different modalities that we know work well in the Latino community specifically. During each session, CHW listens to the community members' struggles and experiences before offering strategies and coping mechanisms that they can incorporate into their life, including mindfulness, behavioral activation, psychoeducation, and self-management. Mentes Fuertes is the first mental health initiative that El Futuro has launched in years in Orange County. The Carrboro location closed due to lack of funding, and while the clinics in Durham and Siler City are still active, it's a long drive for residents to get support. The call for help last May came in the form of a public accountability assembly held at St. Thomas More Catholic Church in Chapel Hill in the midst of a mental health crisis stemming from years of Alliance Health's predecessor denying Medicaid reimbursements to undocumented immigrants. Organizations including Orange County Justice United and North Carolina Congress of Latino Organizations banded together to organize the assembly, inviting religious leaders, public officials, and community members like Huerta to speak about the importance of mental health transparency and community action. Huerta lives in Hillsboro and works as a house cleaner. When she found long wait lists at El Futuro, she looked at private therapy options, but the high cost prevented her from getting help. She says, you use all your tools and all your knowledge to try to carry your emotions, and you say, I can, I can, I can. But you can't if you need help. While North Carolina has over 1 million Hispanic residents, the Latino mental health crisis is not unique to Orange County. Across the nation, only 36% of Hispanic and Latino Americans received mental health services in 2021, 36% compared to 52% of non-Hispanic whites. But Orange County is unique in its perseverance and community action. When Alliance's Chief Operating Officer, Sean Schreiber, announced that $500,000 pledge at the end of May's assembly, there was a spirit of victory in the air. Now, almost a year later, the community is finally feeling the impact of that money through the care they're receiving from the CHWs, says Castro. We were so fortunate in finding the community health workers we did, Castro says. We hired the 4 best people for this role. Anytime anyone hears them speak, you can really feel the commitment they have to our community and to this type of work. The 4 workers are part-time employees, balancing other jobs on top of this community work. They come from different backgrounds. An experienced advocate, an organizer, a community project advisor, a child care specialist, and a medical doctor. At the launch of the program, the CHWs were a little overwhelmed with the amount of material they had to know. But after only a month of delivering sessions, says Castro, it quickly became apparent the four workers were more than capable. Castro says, earlier this year, around February, one of the CHWs came to us and said someone had reached out to him and said, "Hey, you're actually working with one of my friends, and I've seen a change in her, and I want that for myself." That message came after only four or five sessions with a participant. Since then, the program has only grown in numbers. As of March, Mentes Fuertes had 48 recipients enrolled and had completed over 205 program sessions. Despite the program's early success, a new physical space for El Futuro is still up in the air. While the donation from Alliance was intended to initiate a multi-phase return of the brick-and-mortar clinic in Orange County, there are no plans to rebuild that Carborough location. In the meantime, the CHWs have held sessions in community spaces, thanks to partnerships with agencies like the Orange County Rape Crisis Center, St. Thomas More, and Holy Family Catholic Church. El Futuro does community outreach to find Mentes Fuertes participants in those spaces too, says Castro. Quote, "It's really nice because we do outreach at the host site, and then that person can meet us at that site, so they're not having to go somewhere they're unfamiliar with. They're in community still." The CHWs and community members share a connection through their shared language. In North Carolina, 8% of the population 5 years and older spoke Spanish at home between 2018 and 22. Not only do the CHWs speak Spanish as their first language, but they prefer it to English. And for people like Huerta, meeting with Spanish-speaking program staff would keep her from having to pay steep private therapy costs or look outside the United States for mental health support. In addition to breaching language divides, one of the program's biggest successes has been in adapting the curriculum. After months of the CHWs watching videos, reading manuals, doing extra training, and working through role plays, Castro says she is amazed at how well the curriculum works, even in just a short time. Quote, "We had seen the numbers. We knew that it worked. But I think experiencing it for themselves and me experiencing through them, I'm honestly blown away. It's amazing that people have this level of impact." Probably I will have just time to read most of this article. 40 unhoused residents must leave Wake County homeless encampment or face arrest. More than 40 people living in a tent encampment on a state-owned unused lot at the intersection of Highways 401 and US 70 near the Raleigh-Garner border were told to leave by 10 a.m. last Tuesday or face arrest for trespassing. Advocates for the people in the encampment called a 9 a.m. press conference Tuesday to bring attention to what they call an act of unmitigated cruelty, coming as it does during the National Week of Action to oppose the criminalization of homelessness. "The whole thing, in my opinion," said Patrick O'Neill, "is its Raleigh's shame, or even greater, Wake County's shame, that we have so many people living on the streets, in cars, pitching tents on pieces of empty land, and there's nowhere for them to go." Marcia Timmel, a Garner resident and retired Wake County school teacher who organized an Easter meal for the encampment, said she will stand with people who live there and refuse police officers' orders to vacate the property unless Raleigh and Garner officials provide them with a safe alternative. Timmel said Raleigh should not prevent anyone from pitching their tent on public land unless an alternative is provided and help is provided to relocate the unhoused to safer quarters, said Timmel, who is disabled due to Parkinson's disease. The eviction from this encampment near bus lines and shopping would come one day after the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral argument about the constitutionality of ordinances in Grants Pass, Oregon, that bar people who are experiencing homelessness from using blankets, pillows, or cardboard boxes to protect themselves from the elements while sleeping within the city limits. The case could shape municipal homeless policies across the country if upheld by the High Court. Advocacy groups for people experiencing homelessness and others arguing that allowing cities to punish people who need a place to sleep is tantamount to criminalizing homelessness. In an email statement, Julia Milstead, a spokesperson for the city of Raleigh, called the order to leave the site a, quote, difficult and emotional situation for everyone. She stressed that the property is owned by the state of North Carolina and said the city is working with the NC Department of Transportation to find a solution. Milstead said the people in the encampment have, quote, consistently declined services offered by the Raleigh Police Department's addressing crises through outreach, referrals, networking, and service. That's called ACORNS, and the city of Raleigh. Milstead says we will continue to help make connections to programs through the city and provide partners. I don't have time to work anymore on that article. I apologize. And as I mentioned, this was an unusually thick folder of articles. I've had to leave a lot of arts and music and movie reviews, etc., in my folder, for hopefully to parse out during the next couple of issues. So as of now, John Fetterson has to say farewell and thank you for listening to Indie Week. This is available and after the initial broadcast on Friday in our podcast section at ncreadingservice.org. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll be back next week with the Indie Week.